From the Ghost Tactical Production Studio, welcome to the Armed Citizen Podcast. And now your host, Trey Miller.
Welcome to the Armed Citizen Podcast. I am your host, Trey Miller, with Ghost Tactical Productions, and thank you for joining us this week for the podcast. And we've got a very special guest. He's a very good friend of mine and someone who has been involved in the Second Amendment community, the social media side, gun activists. He's anything and everything that you could possibly think of. I like to call him the godfather of the gun community, and he doesn't really like that, but it's okay. We've got G-Webs, which you guys might know him as Gun Websites. He's a social media activist and real life activist, but he's been around doing this gang for, you know, almost 20 years, I think. So welcome to the show, G. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I've been looking forward to it.
You've been around basically the internet since the internet kind of was conceived, and you've seen people come and go. You've seen activists come and go. You've seen all sorts of stuff come and go, but in the gun community, starting in 2013, you know, it kind of started to get where there's a lot of gun activity on YouTube and different things. How has it changed in the last 5 years from maybe when you started 10 years ago?
Well, like you say, when 13, we had the reaction to the Sandy Hook, and the reaction to Sandy Hook was 23 executive actions by Obama with a completely Democrat House and Senate. And there was some serious concern that he would be able to just walk all kinds of laws through at the executive side. So there was a tremendous reaction in general, but through echoed through social media and YouTube specifically. And that's when YouTube, the firearms portion of YouTube really took off. And like you say, the initial resistance to that assumption that he could just change federal law through executive actions because he wasn't satisfied with the speed of the Congress. You know, for people that want to see government work correctly and not see it manipulated for a specific concern. I'm sure a lot of people were involved for that, but also, of course, because it was about firearms, it rallied the call to arms, you know, for the firearms community to come alive and work in unison. And that part was amazing. But at the same time, it brought the attention, the media spotlight to all these creators on YouTube that had had years of experience, you know, creating content and sort of, I don't want to say ignored, but certainly not with any kind of national attention. It really allowed some of the firearms channels to blossom. They had streams of income through YouTube. At that point, YouTube was paying us significantly to create content. And the people that, like I say, had had already years of experience were able to now have years of experience with resources. And that allowed, you know, the channels we all know, Hickok, Military Arms Channel, Iraqi Veteran, to take, you know, step it up a level in levels of production, levels of ambition. You know, if they wanted to do a series, now they had the ability to do the whole series, not just, you know, do it whenever they had time. So to answer your question, how did it change in the last 5 years? I think it's grown and blossomed, and probably at not quite at an exponential level, but certainly at an increased level of growth than it would naturally have occurred. I think quite a bit of positive came out of it. Number one, the community as a whole, gun owners, people that wanted to see the system of government here in the United States work correctly. All of those people were able to come together and resist that influence by Obama at the time, which would have been really detrimental. That would have set precedent. That would have been horrible for future anything besides guns. I mean, almost any social issue, if the president could just decide to make changes, that really alters our government. So I think that for that reason, it strengthened the country and the new media, the people that were using alternative media sources to reach out to the culture, to the communities. And because people were so receptive at that time, you know, these channels got a voice that they would have never had before. You know, the first 5 years of growth on YouTube was not a struggle, but it was casual. And the last 5 years have been both deliberate and funded at a level that, you know, we would have never had without those horrible things that happened, you know, and the results of them. So it's not always perfect. I'd personally rather see a little more flavor than what we see. I think we see a lot of people trying to emulate old television shows or emulate old types of production that's kind of repetitive. But at the same time, they've had time to explore. I mean, look at some of the big channels. They've had time to explore some things that are their passions and their interests that, you know, no television show would have ever put resources towards.
I know that you kind of moved, and you were ever really that kind of a person that was more worried about the entertainment side. You were more worried about getting information and cataloging information and the time of history and where the gun community was in each individual year. You're an historian of the firearms community, and you've kind of transitioned over the last 5-6 years more to the 2A activist side of things. And how big does YouTube or social media, does the impact that they have on the activist side?
Well, there's a couple of questions there. First off, let me say, I've never attempted to do much with my channels other than share my interests. So my interests have changed over time because I'm a regular human being. So when I first started doing YouTube, it was to answer a few questions on forums. And back then, when YouTube was just starting out and when I started to play with YouTube, I've talked about this before, it was really a forum-based internet. Most of the conversation out there was happening on forums, and some of them were pretty brutal. Like they were, the kids that are savvy and have all the time in the world to spend on the forums can get pretty abusive and sarcastic, and it made it intolerable for people who just wanted to have a conversation or share. So there was alternative forums out there, and you know, because they were smaller and tougher to find, it was a little bit tougher for community to exist. So because of that, it was more of small groups. And when someone would discover us, our small group was called gunchat.net. And I just created a forum where I wanted people to be able to ask questions and experience the firearms community without being embarrassed or feeling like they were going to get abused for asking a simple question. That was about as high tech as we could get on the internet. You know, we didn't have all high speed connections yet, so there was no such thing as high speed bandwidth. But basically, we would take guns that were used out to the range to test fire them, or maybe some gunsmithing was done and we wanted to verify function. And I would just take the cameras with and shoot over the shoulders as the guys from the shop would be test firing guns. And at first, that was articles, and I guess you'd call them like blogs, you know, with photographs, because there wasn't, like say, high speed internet yet. But then as YouTube came around and putting video up was practical and cost effective, you know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words, a video's worth a lot more than that. So, putting some stuff up on video was just a natural progression from sharing whatever we were doing with pictures. Then YouTube started becoming more of a thing, and there was community on YouTube. I guess I changed my strategy a little bit to share what we were doing here in Tucson with our friends back east, and with people I knew back east weren't able to do the kind of stuff we were able to do in Arizona. So I guess you could say my original stuff on YouTube turned out to be a lot of gun reviews, but it wasn't for the sake of reviewing the gun. It was for the sake of sharing the experience with people that either couldn't be there or never experienced it before. Yeah, our goal was never to just create an archive of gun reviews. That just sort of happened. Once they were there, though, my internet side, I guess, the side of me that plays with the internet, was getting a little frustrated that they were just kind of haphazard. So I had quite a few sites that would do things like have gun reviews or stuff. So I guess at some extent I would, you know, see if like I had a bunch of Ruger stuff, but I didn't have a Ruger revolver. I might have made a few videos intentionally just to fill some gaps as we were building the websites. But basically, I was just saying I never really sat down to make a channel for gun reviews. There wasn't a lot of people training, so I would try to explain some of the training stuff, the classes that we would go to. A lot of trainers would come to Arizona, and since I knew most of them, they had no problem with me showing up and just hanging out and recording some of their stuff. And really enjoyed that. The beginning video into the training stuff, like I say, that was kind of fun because not a lot of people had tried to do that yet. And the instructors really dug it. And it gave me a chance to meet a lot of the instructors and hang out. And the best part of going to a training class, especially a remote one where the instructor is not in their home location, is that they have to go eat dinner. They have to go eat lunch. Sometimes they eat breakfast. So, you know, having opportunities to hang out with those people off the clock is always interesting, especially when you're friends with them. They start telling you all kinds of interesting stories and you hear all kinds of neat stuff. So that was super fun. And then, well, YouTube quit paying me. So I learned my lesson and started to explore other things as well. So I don't know if that answers the question, but it's certainly long-winded.
Being part of the activist side, you know, what is a role or how have you used social media to extend you becoming more of a Second Amendment activist instead of maybe a gun channel celebrity or a YouTube, you know, person that's just a YouTube guy? You've actually moved on into getting more into rallies and being talking and going to the gun rights policy conference and all of that to the activist side. How have you utilized social media and your reach from YouTube to help that out?
That's a good question. I don't think I have done that well, and I haven't, certainly haven't done it enough, but I think I don't sit down. I didn't never sat down and had a strategy. I've always considered my social media stuff like a pro hobby, I don't know, a hobby that pays for itself. It's never supported me. I shouldn't say that. It hasn't supported me since 2012, but for a little while there, it supported me. But it's never been my income, my 100% of my income, really. So I've always considered it a bit of a plaything, a bit of an experiment. And I have absolutely no interest in copying what somebody else has done. So I think that as far as activism goes, I experienced I started to understand the activism side of the firearms community through Charles Heller, listening to his Sunday morning show in Tucson. And I've been listening to that. I don't even remember not listening to it. So it's been a long, long time. He's been on air for 20 something years, 22 years. I've listened to a good majority of those shows, and Charles is just in his roots, a firearms activist. So I understood what a true firearms activist was. I thought he was a rare individual that was just, you know, completely and utterly into the Second Amendment. So as I went to the Gun Rights Policy Conference at his urging in Phoenix in 2010, I had known about the Gun Rights Policy Conference for many years before that. In fact, I had helped Charles year after year to help him with the audio because he does the audio for the conference. But listening to it for all those years, it didn't sink in. So experiencing it in 2010, going into that room with, I guess that year it was about 400 something people who were the creators, the founders of these organizations, the people that run those organizations, the people that fund those organizations, which are also interesting people, and then just activists like myself who are, you know, different levels. But going into that room, there was such a level of excitement or like a feeling in the room that was just so invigorating that I was hooked. And again, this was 2010. I was still kind of playing. I was making some money on YouTube. And as I started to dig into the history, the investment, the machinery, you know, just going on tours and seeing the manufacturers, checking out gun shops and stuff, going to gun shows. And all through these years, gun shows have died. You know, gun shows have, especially with 2013, we talked about what it was like on YouTube. Let's talk about what it was like with gun shows during 2013. That was the ammo shortages. Gun shows went from a place where you went to hang out and chat with people and discover things to collect that you never knew about, or to ask questions about crazy guns that you couldn't imagine why they would look like that, or to ask the difference between this gun and that gun, or to, you know, buy that $75 Comblock pistol or that $75 Comblock rifle with that $75 thousand rounds of ammunition for them. It went from that kind of an experience to, where do I get 22 long rifle? Where's the cheapest place to get 9mm? Where am I going to get some 223 because Obama's going to take it all? So the gun shows turned into distribution channels for the ammunition suppliers that didn't have brick and mortar. So it was like the Barnes and Noble or the Borders books of ammunition. Like, they took over gun shows the same way that Borders and Barnes and Noble took over the distribution of books from small bookstores. So gun shows turned into people just lining up to buy ammo, and all the tables that had collectible stuff or reloading stuff or you know, different stuff from the various campaigns throughout, you know, different wars and stuff throughout the years, all those people quit going to shows, and they basically, you know, however, a person who just dabbles in collecting things, you know, here and there a couple of times a year, you know, whatever the equivalent of them going out of business happened. And gun shows just changed. They went from kind of, you know, struggling to just barely being alive. And I don't know if they'll recover, unfortunately, because with that, the people that went to gun shows stopped going to gun shows, because now all of a sudden the gun shows were just for the masses to get their ammunition cheaper. And it stayed like that for a good year and a half. It was like that for a long time. So as I'm, you know, experiencing the Gun Rights Policy Conference, and then the next couple of years, I see all that happen. I just decided to start showing more interesting stuff, what I find interesting about the gun community. So that's turned into, you know, emphasizing the different stuff that I do, the gun shows and the gun shops. And I like to play with the tech. So seeing the live stuff happen really changed it for a lot of us. Being able to have a community of people that's maybe not hundreds of thousands of people all over the world, but it's dozens of people who actually give a dang and, you know, show up every week to be part of a conversation, sometimes show up daily to be part of a conversation. Through all that, that I've tried to offer diversity and intentionally not gone with what's easy. So if what people want is what's the new Ruger, I'm going to do the opposite. And that'll be going to some boring museum somewhere and showing them what they've never knew they didn't care about. And, you know, it's driving my channel into the ground, but I don't care. I mean, it's still there and it's still on YouTube. And that little museum now has a presence on the internet. And if somebody's driving by and they stop by, and like you've mentioned, you know, and that person gets enthusiastic, or their kid finds out that guns are interesting more than they thought, then we win, right? We only have to change one or two people each.
So, G, when you hear the words armed citizen, what do those words mean to you?
Well, okay. So I grew up in the 70s and 80s with my experience with firearms. And back then, I guess people would have been called, like preppers would have been called survivalists. And I think my dad would have been called a survivalist. So for me, it's just always been part of being a citizen. You do civic things for your community. You vote. My family, you enlist, and you do your service, and then you'd have firearms. It's our duty to be armed. So I don't know. For me, it's just a duty of someone who takes the responsibility of being a citizen. If you're physically able and you're mentally able, then it's just a part of being a citizen. So for the longest time, I didn't question it, and it was not uncomfortable, and it didn't seem weird. I guess some people don't agree, but it's never been a, you have to make a decision one way or the other. I think I've probably changed, or, you know, given it some nuance now that I'm older and I've experienced a lot more, and the world has changed, and we are literally under attack as gun owners for lots of reasons, from people that put no interest or no emphasis or no respect to that concept of that personal responsibility of a citizen. So I think now, if I think an armed citizen, I would think of it as the representation of freedom. When, and I've said this a lot, and I like to think of it as the citizen's ownership of firearms is the ultimate expression of individual liberty, of freedom, and lack of fear of your neighbors. So I guess my definition would be, an armed citizen is the definition of a free individual.
You grew up with guns, being around with your dad and all that. Do you remember your first memory of handling and firing a gun? And do you remember what kind of gun it was?
I've always had a gun. When my mom and dad got married, my dad gave my mom a single action 22 and she didn't want it. And when I was born, it was mine. So I imagine at some point when I was little, I was told that a bunch of times. So I've just always known I own guns. And then I would just inherit guns that I wanted. So if my dad had a bunch of guns, I would say that one's mine and that one's mine. And he didn't argue. My parents were divorced. So all I ever remember is my dad picking me up and us going shooting. at least as my earliest memories. The rule was if I wanted to go shooting on the weekends, I needed to reload. So my experience has just always been, you know, on weekends we're guns, we're shooting, was getting ready to go hunting or something, or reloading to go shooting, or maybe every once in a while buy a new gun. But yeah, I don't have like a first time I went shooting. My dad basically owned every gun from the Civil War to now. So I would just kind of go into different moods and eras, I guess, and shoot guns for a while and then get sick of those and move to some other pile of guns and shoot those for a few weeks. And I just always had plenty to choose from, and everybody was excited about shooting and the whole family would shoot. So just always been part of our family life, I guess.
For me, I wasn't around guns growing up, you know, and I grew up in Dallas, so in suburbia, and so guns weren't very prevalent. Now you had the guys that always had the shotguns in the back of the pickups and all that, but I mean, it didn't seem, that wasn't weird to me, but I didn't really get into guns until I joined the Marine Corps and shot the M16A2. I was like, oh, no, this is something I can get into. And then obviously throughout the last, you know, 20 years of that, 25 years, it's become more and more prevalent in my life. And the last probably 5 to 6 years, I've kind of adopted that, the gun lifestyle type thing. And people talk about the gun life and the gun lifestyle and the gun culture and all that. And we talk about how we got into it. I think it's really interesting that for you, you never got into it. That's just life for you. And yeah. You know, some people are like that. They don't remember a time when there wasn't a gun in their hand or guns weren't a part of their life. So it's not a lifestyle for them. It's just life, you know? So when you were at the Gun Rights Policy Conference this past weekend in Chicago, and you had mentioned earlier, it's kind of interesting to be in the same room as these people that are doing a life's work for the Second Amendment. Was the sense of we've got a chance at this, or whether is there fear, was there anger, was there disappointment in the community, or what was the general feeling in that room this year?
That's a good question. That first year when I went in 2010, I don't know that there was any, there was a lot of congratulations for what had happened in 2009. And I think that was some of the exhilaration in the room that I felt, but there was no fear in 2010. Nobody knew what was coming in 12 or anything. This year, it wasn't, there was no fear at all. There was concern of apathy. And I don't know how to explain what it's like when a bunch of people are aware of the apathy. It's sort of a frustration, and it's sort of a, we know we need to do something, but how do we do it? And there was no one, when there's not like a person to ask, but it's that sort of, at least for me, that's sort of the way I saw it. There was no irrational exuberance about nothing. Like nobody was patting themselves on the back about nothing. There was one section of the conference where they talked about the last assault weapons ban. I believe it got defeated in November of 2017, but it only was defeated, if I remember right, by one Democrat vote. Like in other words, one vote, we would have had this other assault weapons ban. And I don't remember that really being on people's radar. So there was a bit of like concern that this almost happened, but without raising an alarm, if that makes sense. So it wasn't like people were like unjustifiably unaware or like unjustifiably unconcerned. They are aware that it's not a done deal. And just because we have Trump, we don't have a clear shot to anything we want. We know that Trump is a bit of a wild card. So I'd say it was short of optimistic, but it was definitely not pessimistic. I'd say if anything, it was probably about neutral. Now, for me personally, with midterms coming up, and because we have Trump, even though he isn't a sure thing for everything we've got, he's definitely a better potential than anything we could have had. And anything we've ever had. So I would have certainly liked to see more of a feeling of let's get some stuff done. Or I would have liked to see a lot of stuff thrown out on the table. Like, let's see this pass. Let's move this. Let's move on this. Let's overwhelm them with pro-gun stuff. I guess that's just me being a little pessimistic. You know, I'd like to see us have the world. I want no NFA and I want, you know, constitutional carry everywhere.
So transitioning from being just, you know, a YouTuber trying to catalog and tell your position and your thoughts and your vision for the Second Amendment into actually getting on the ground roots and being out there doing it, you started up with what's called the Gun Show Loophole Tour. And this is where you are in your van or in a vehicle and you go out for a month to 2 months or ever how long it's going to take, and you state to state, city to city, and you're stomping in, going to gun shows, and you're going to gun shops, and you're representing the Second Amendment and trying to, you know, be a scribe of what the Second Amendment is in the heartland of America. How did that concept come up? And I know you're on tour right now, and what are your goals this year for this the Gun Show Loophole Tour?
Right on. Yeah. So as like you say, it started out in 2004 building websites just to share our experiences out here in Arizona with my friends back in the east of the Mississippi, who I know couldn't do some of the stuff we could do out in the desert out there. And they were fairly interested. So I put up these websites. As I explained before, the YouTube community started to happen. The people that were creating videos started to talk to each other. The audiences, we shared our audiences to a large point, and the audiences would have conversations that would keep going from video to video. We could do video responses back then. So there was this community that was being born that, in stark contrast to the forums, was very pleasant, was very welcoming, and very approachable for new people. So I saw this happening, and we started to make some money. Like YouTube would just pay us, in other words. So a couple of us started to hang out more and more. This was before live chat, so we had to, I don't know, maybe make phone calls or emails and stuff. So we were just barely being able to kind of get ourselves together and form alliances and collaborate on videos and stuff. So in 2010, I started to travel. SHOT Show went to Florida in 2007 and then in 2009. So it cost us, I think, $3,000 to go to SHOT Show in 2009. And I wasn't making that much money. So that was sort of an investment into the future. Videos were just happening. We bought a camera that year from Circuit City and then filmed and then came home to Tucson and brought the camera back to the store. So we were doing it on a tight budget. So we experienced video and stuff in 2009 and experienced how much it costs to travel. So in 2010, I wanted to continue doing that. And I was working with FrontSight in Nevada, and they paid us, I think, $2,000 to help us go to NRA show in Charlotte. So we went there, and I liked the idea of traveling and getting around the country because I like the country. It's a cool country. So in 2012, I no longer had any interest in just attending trade shows. So instead, I bought a cop car and I invited my friend Haas, the Marine, down from Washington. He came down to Tucson. We got in the cop car with the Doberman and we just drove. And our goal was to meet up with Mad Bed Voodoo, Cutlery Lover, Hickok, Eric, and a couple other people, Such. And at the time, those were people who were, up and coming. They weren't quite big yet, but they were on our heels. So they were all up and coming. And I thought, you know, we're making money on YouTube. Let's become a community. So me and Haas got in the car, and I figured, since I'm driving all around the country, let's call some companies and see if we can't get tours. So, we're driving around the country doing factory tours, and it was super fun. It was an experience. So drove around the country in the cop car and came home. And I basically spent all my YouTube money that year on that trip. And it was financially unsuccessful, but it was certainly, to my soul, it was food for the soul. It was awesome driving around the country and experiencing factories and chatting with the manufacturers. And we saw a couple of museums. We got downstairs at the NRA museum that year. So I had had a bunch of successes on that trip and quite a few failures. So it took a couple of years to get back to financial footings. Basically, I liked the idea of driving around the country, and I was looking for something to do something different. So that's where the Gun Show Loophole came from, a way to play with our audience in real life in a different way than, you know, some cookie cutter way trying to emulate a TV show. So now when I started to drive around, instead of looking at factories, because much as I like looking at factories, I like gun shows or gun shops and gun shows and or surplus stores. So I figured out, hey, what if I drove around just looking at gun shops? As soon as I started going into gun shops and kind of getting rejuvenated with my love of gun shops, you know, once you see, I don't know, 60 or 70 different gun shops, you start to see the differences and the similarities, and you want to start sharing that with people. So that sort of passion happened. I didn't sit down to come up with it, but it happened. And now it's ultimately satisfying. Like I go into a gun shop now and, you know, I just come in out of nowhere and, hey, my shop. Okay. Come take some pictures. Why? Well, I do this podcast. Okay. I take some pictures, you know, and the conversation will keep going. Nine times, honestly, I would say 9 times out of 10, once we start talking, you know, I find out how long the shop's been there, what kind of ups and downs they've had, the kind of customers they have. And it's just super cool. I mean, imagine you're in a gun shop and just somebody walks in and is just truly interested in what you're doing there. And you get to talk about it for a little while, not trying to sell them a damn thing. And then now I try to buy $20 or $50 worth of stuff when I'm there. So I buy, if they've got logo merchandise, I buy that. And yeah, it's just neat when you can go in and chat with a shop for a little while. I always leave with saying thank you for being here. And I think that's, I don't know, it's helping out just those shops in general. But if I can, next my challenge is to get that on the internet, you know, get that experience out there so that people can see some of the diversity of these shops and have a nice, simple, easy place to browse through some of these shops. I'm really hoping that the shops will be able to learn from each other. Some of the displays, some of the marketing that they use, some of the layouts and things. Hopefully they'll be able to learn from each other and be better shops, see some of the feedback people give and, you know, be able to interact with customers at a different level. And hopefully we're strengthening the shops and creating an interest in checking out shops. And, you know, with that in conjunction with the Daily Gun Show, I'm happy to see. I mean, look, if I don't know, maybe other people don't pay attention, but there's quite a few people that'll take pictures of their shops now and post them on Instagram. I'm assuming people take the same thing and do it on Facebook. I don't use Facebook too much. But if that concept of sharing your shop, sharing your local surplus store, ideally sharing some experiences at a gun show, having individuals participate in that, that's the true power of the new media, is to, you know, set something in motion and have many people effort towards it so that all of a sudden we have more than any single individual could ever come up with. And what are we doing? We're focusing on these shops that are important. So anyway, it's something that sort of evolved from lots of different ways and is, you know, as it's kind of developing, I sure hope it keeps going because it's becoming really fun. I'm hoping I can do my end of it and share that with people in a way that they think it's valuable and continue to support it, because, you know, we're doing it on a shoestring right now and it's working.
It's more than just a gun shop. It used to be where people would go every morning and have their coffee and just hang out and be friends and all of that. And it's nice to know that they're still out there, but it's nice that you're documenting this. And I think there are a lot of people out there, myself included, I know I am, but enjoy seeing your travels and enjoy seeing what a gun shop looks like in Oregon versus a gun shop in Nebraska versus a gun shop in Pennsylvania versus a gun shop in Alabama. It's just really kind of cool to see, you know, I know what gun shops are and look like here, but they might be completely different in Oregon, or they might be something different in North Dakota or whatever. So I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a road trip at the grandest scale for the Second Amendment, which I think is awesome. You know, being out in the road, you see America, and it's not America through a biased media. It's not America through what the marketing directors want you to see. It's America, and you're seeing the Second Amendment lived every day. You're seeing what gun people are doing every single day, and the ranges that you might happen to drive past in Illinois versus a range in San Antonio, Texas, are going to be different between urban and rural or whatever. And it's just a kind of a cool Americana feeling. And I'd love to do that. I wish I had the time to just jump in the van and be your co-pilot for a month. I'd love to do that. And maybe one day I will have the time to do that, but that's something that I think is amazing to me. I've got a few questions, kind of a rapid fire type thing. And I want to kind of go through them real quick without going through all my guests. So the first one is, and I'm not going to say like geographically, I'm not saying geographically, where will you be? But where do you see yourself in a year from now with your projects, with different things that you're going through right now? Where do you see you and your channel and all of that a year from now?
I'd like to have built some easily digestible and easily understandable quick guides to the various social media platforms for people that are creating Second Amendment content, so that we can take the how, like the how do I do this question, off the table. So I'd like to have accomplished that. I hope that we can get significantly farther ahead with changing the gun owners' rights groups concept of getting together once a year for the gun rights policy conference. I mean, I don't want to diminish that. Getting together physically in the same location, especially the way Alan Gottlieb does it in alternatively gun-friendly and non-gun-friendly cities, that's critically important. I don't want to put that down. It was life-changing for me to attend that event for the first time. It's crucial. However, it's not something that can only happen once a year. So I think that there needs to be something like the Every Second Matters, where we get together on a specific day every single month and reorganize, re-strategize, get together, network, and all that as a Second Amendment activist community. So I hope to do something more towards getting that on a bigger scale. Because right now we keep lifting each other up to see over the wall, but we got to quit lifting each other up. Every time somebody comes along and says, "What's over that wall?" we lift them up and let them look. We need to just build a ramp so that we can jump over that wall and worry about the next wall or the next trench or whatever it happens to be.
If money was no object, ammo cost no object, what would your dream gun be?
PKMs. They're the funnest to shoot. They're neat. And 7.62 by 54 is a man's round. And they're upside down AKs that are huge. They're belt fed. Pick them up and shoot them. Put them on a bipod and shoot them. Mount them to a vehicle and shoot them, put them in aircraft and shoot them. For a while there was a machine gun shoot in Tucson that I got invited to. And it was just a bunch of people that own machine guns would get out once in a while and shoot. So I've shot a lot of the Volter PKMs. They made some semi-autos, but they made lots of full autos for contractors and stuff. So Eric was cool, and I probably shot many thousands of rounds through the Volter PKMs.
I know you have a bunch of projects you've got going on right now. I want to give you a few minutes to kind of plug anything that you want to get out to the public that may not be aware of what you're doing and what your projects are. So go ahead and kind of tell everybody what your websites are and what you're doing.
Right on. Yeah, I definitely have a lot of stuff in sticks in the fire or whatever. So if you just go to gunwebsites.com, you'll get a pretty good table of contents of what we do. We have a community over on gunchannels.com, which is strong, and it's about to hit its fifth year. We've got the Every Second Matters campaign, which is an awareness campaign that was started by a group of people back in the end of 2013 when we just started to see the apathy begin. Everybody who had been very adamantly pro-Second Amendment out of nowhere, you know, in resistance to the 23 executive orders from Obama, you know, after a year and after successfully repelling those or, you know, kind of beating them down, we started to see some apathy. So as a group of people on YouTube, we got together and came up with this concept of intentionally talking about the Second Amendment once a month. And we do that on the second day. So I'm proud to, you know, keep life in that project. And that's certainly open to anyone who's interested in participating, either a lot or a little or occasionally or every day. We have the Gun Show Loophole Tour, which we've talked about. That's supported through our Patreon supporters, people that financially throw money at me every month to do work like this, to get out and check out gun shops and gun shows, and really appreciate that. I would not be able to do it without their support. And then, of course, we have gear websites. So I don't try to entertain you on YouTube, so I don't get paid there. I don't try to impress anybody with super knowledge or, you know, antics. So I don't make a bunch of extra money on Patreon from that. Instead, I try to offer goods and services. So we make morale patches. We do some other products. I've been doing the playing cards, things that are hopefully Second Amendment, of interest to Second Amendment people, but are goods and services that are not services, goods that you can just purchase. So we have a store and it's called Gear Websites. That's the majority of our projects, but you can find them all at gunwebsites.com.
Well, G, you know, you have been doing this for a long time and you are an inspiration to a lot of people, and myself included, obviously. You've been a huge part of my last year and some months on the YouTube game, if you should call it, but I appreciate you mentoring me and mentoring all these younger people that are just coming in, and not just about the YouTube side. You're a mentor about the Second Amendment, and there's a lot of stuff that I've learned just having, you know, phone calls and chats. I've been on there for hours and hours sometimes and just hanging out and talking, and it's, I want to say thank you for all that you're doing for us and you're doing for the Second Amendment. And you know, I'm honored to call you a friend of mine, and I thank you for so much for coming on to the show. And I really do appreciate you getting out there and doing a gun show loophole tour, getting out there and going to the Gun Rights Policy Conference and everything that you're doing to promote and protect the Second Amendment. So thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Right on. Thanks for having me, brother. It's been a pleasure.
Well, once again, guys, I want to thank G Webbs for joining us the show this week. Thank you to everyone who's been supporting and listening to the show. I really appreciate it. This is only our third episode, but I feel like it's gaining traction, and I'm looking forward to what comes of this. I've already got some really awesome guests lined up for the next couple months that I think you guys are going to enjoy. So make sure you go and listen to all the prior podcasts. Make sure you go check out all of the Tactical Tuesday live shows. They're in podcast form. And we also invite you guys to go check out all of our social media content. If you want links to all of those different platforms, you can go and visit our website, www.ghosttacticalproductions.com. Thanks for listening to the Armed Citizen Podcast. To check out our full lineup of pro-gun media content, including our product reviews, live shows, and other Second Amendment activity, please check out our website, www.ghosttacticalproductions.com.